Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will have information about a new program in Columbus that helps nursing home level patients maintain their independence and live at home. Jay will also talk to experts on life experience college credits and Central Ohio Key Clubs. Plus, Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
PACE is a Medicare and Medicaid program that stands for Program for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. The program is designed to help seniors maintain their independence. The first PACE center in Columbus opened in July, and it is estimated that over 220,000 Ohioans age 55 and older could be eligible. Ursel McElroy, Ohio Department of Aging Director, joins us now on Columbus Perspective, and we welcome you and say good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Now, I fall into that category, so this is particularly interesting to me. What does PACE provide for its participants?
Absolutely. So PACE offers a wide range of options, such as your medical care, if you need home health services, counseling, and even respite care for families that are caring for loved ones.
Now, the age parameters for the program have recently changed. What was it before and what is it now?
So to be eligible for a PACE program, you must be at least 55 years of age. You have to live in the service area of a PACE organization. It's also expected that you need what's called a nursing home level of care, so a certain level of assistance you would need, and that you can live safely in the community with help from the PACE program.
And this allows you to live in your own residence or the residence of a family member, correct?
Absolutely. And we know that older Ohioans have repeatedly told us they prefer to spend their golden years at home. And so PACE helps us to do that.
Yeah, I can't imagine living without my cats. So that's good news.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So where in Central Ohio is the PACE program available?
So we just opened a PACE center in Franklin County, and we're really excited about that PACE center. As you might be aware, we also are opening PACE across the state. You'll see that there are PACE centers that will be opening in Hamilton County, Montgomery, Lorain, Lucas, and Summit counties as examples.
What are the income qualifications for the PACE program?
So for the PACE program, first, we would certainly want you to have a good assessment so we can better understand what your resources are. But the PACE program can support individuals who are private pay, also those who receive Medicare and or Medicaid. So it's a pretty broad range. It really is specific to your situation. And so we would certainly encourage anyone who is interested in these services to reach out to your local PACE organization to be certain that perhaps you could qualify.
Now, we talked earlier about what you called nursing home level care. Let's drill down on that a little bit. What exactly does that mean?
Well, that means for someone who needs assistance with what we call activities of daily living. So, for example, if you're an individual that needs assistance with toileting, perhaps with feeding, maybe someone to help you to sponge off or wash off during the day, there is a wide range of what we call activities of daily living that we look at to see, does this person need assistance with those?
Now, how much does it cost the individual or perhaps their Medicare or Medicaid assistance program? What's the cost to this program?
So, again, it really depends on what the individual's needs are, but a monthly premium typically covers the long-term care portion of the PACE benefit for your Medicare. So if you're paying your Medicare monthly premium, that will cover your PACE benefit. And for those who are on Medicaid, Medicaid picks up the balance of that cost. So there's no deductible or co-payment for any drug, service, or care that the healthcare team approves for the individual. And again, if you don't have Medicare or Medicaid, you still can pay for PACE yourself.
Now, did you mention that transportation is part of the program?
Transportation is a huge part of the PACE program. Many of the individuals are transported to a PACE center. And with that center, it is very easy to help a caregiver by providing transportation, particularly if someone has a little difficulty getting in and out of a traditional vehicle. And so oftentimes the PACE center will have sort of a van or transportation that is accustomed to helping someone who needs assistance with getting in and out of that vehicle. They will pick them up, bring them safely to the center, and then at the end of the day, return them as well. And again, this is a part of that PACE benefit, so there's no additional cost for that portion.
What about socialization? I know that for many older Ohioans who have either lost a spouse or have outlived their friends and family, loneliness is a huge concern to their mental and then eventually physical health. How does the PACE program address that issue?
Absolutely, and what a great point to bring up. For many individuals who require a great deal of assistance, this means that oftentimes that assistance is brought into their home, and that's fine, but they don't often have the opportunity then to get out and to mingle with people or to socialize with people. And we know, as you've just earlier stated, that having that social connection has a huge impact on your physical health, your mental health, and your emotional well-being. And so if we can have people to come and to be able to meet with people, interact with people, socialize with people, it helps them. It helps with those connections, and it helps to address those issues that we know can prematurely impact one's physical and mental decline.
How is potential, I should rephrase that, how are potential cuts in federal funding, the length of the government shutdown, which may or may not be over by the time this airs, and all other issues with regard to health care, how is that impacting the PACE program, which appears to be expanding?
Absolutely. So while Congress and the President negotiate on a spending plan, the Department of Aging remains prepared and positioned to maintain continuity of services and operations at the state level as permissible. At this time, we've not seen any cuts that we've had to have in the PACE program or any of our programs for that matter. And so we're continuing to keep an eye on that to be sure that our individuals who are some of the most at-risk folks that we can serve are able to continue to receive those services without disruption. We understand how important that is for the individuals and their families. And again, we're doing all that we can and continuing to monitor the situation in Washington.
Yeah, I would imagine you are. If it is a program that one has to enroll in, does the caretaker take on that responsibility, or can the individual patient do that? And how can they do it? Do they have to go to the office, or can they do it online?
So that is something that either that caregiver or the individual can do, certainly whenever possible. We love to have the individual involved. You can certainly contact the PACE organization near you to determine an enrollment plan for you or your loved one. Information can be found on the Department of Aging's website, and that's at aging, A-G-I-N-G, .ohio.gov /PACE. So aging.ohio.gov/PACE. You can certainly get more information about the PACE program.
Now, out of curiosity, are there volunteer opportunities within the program for people to participate in that socialization and emotional well-being component?
Absolutely. I would certainly encourage anyone who's interested in volunteering to contact that PACE organization within your area to see what their particular needs are. But I can't imagine that there isn't a place for you at a PACE center to volunteer. These PACE centers not only help the individuals, but they help the entire community. And I think it's important for your listeners to know that we conducted a market analysis before embarking on this very exciting exciting effort to understand where it made the most sense to have a PACE center. There are different factors that are considered, but we wanted to be sure that we weren't oversaturating a market, and at the same time that we didn't have these deserts that were in dire need. And so we believe, with the assistance of the General Assembly, that we've done a really good job in the placement of this first tranche of PACE centers, and we look forward to having more spring up throughout the state.
Now, I thought of one more question as we were speaking. How is the PACE program going to tackle food insecurity as things like SNAP benefits are in jeopardy and the food pantries are in dire need of assistance themselves?
Absolutely. And food security is critical to many older Ohioans, both those who are within our PACE programs and those not. It is something that we are very engaged with. We provide many home-delivered meals, as well as meals at other congregate settings, such as our senior centers. But for the PACE program in particular, those individuals that come are able to receive a nutritious meal each day. Those meals are a part of that PACE benefit that an individual receives when you come in. And so, again, for those PACE participants, I have no concerns about them as the centers are up and functional and operating. But just know that this is a much more expansive issue that we continue to monitor and to see what we can do to get resources into these local communities.
All right. We want to thank Ursel McElroy for joining us from the Ohio Department of Aging. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
There are more than 100,000 college students here in Columbus and even more in the greater central Ohio area. According to a 2025 annual study by National Student Clearinghouse, more than 43 million people attended some college but left without earning a degree or a credential. Now, for many, those reasons for leaving school could have been financial, personal, or family-related. Devin Andrews is Vice President for Admissions and Evaluation at the University of Phoenix. She joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss how people can potentially turn learning from work and life experience into college credit. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So it used to be that if you dropped out for whatever reason, you likely had to start over. Is that no longer the case? And if so, when did that change?
Well, the reality is that's probably not been the case for many, many years, but not everybody understands that. When you drop out of school, a lot of times you can take those college credits and transfer them to another institution. One of the things we want to talk about here today, too, is there's some other hidden potential that adult learners don't always know about.
So what life experiences can actually help you get college credit?
There are a wide variety of experiences that could count. Many adults have learning that they've obtained from their work and life experiences, like professional training programs, exams, or other sources. And those give them knowledge and understanding that's at the same level as a student who may have taken a course in a similar subject at a college or university. In fact, in a recent Harris poll that we conducted, our research showed us that 39% of employed adults spend more than 10 hours a month developing new skills, and universities and colleges can assess that learning and award credit towards a degree. Sometimes that might come from a standardized activity like a national testing program or a workplace certification. And also many large employers like McDonald's, Walmart, and others have some of their training programs evaluated by the American Council on Education for credit recommendations.
But they actually have to be evaluated in order to count. You can't just say, I did this, this, and this. What do you think?
That's right. And, the institution that you choose is going to have different ways in which they're going to recognize that credit. So it may be that they're using credit recommendations from the American Council on Education, as I mentioned. It may be that they have an assessment process that they have in place, like submitting a portfolio or doing a challenge exam. So there's different mechanisms that a school may use to evaluate that experience to determine if it's college level. level learning.
So how do you take the first step? What paces do we need to engage in to make sure that our experience is credited?
First and foremost, it's really important to document your learning experiences. So start by thinking about all of your past college coursework, but also include learning experiences like we've talked about that might be outside the classroom, such as military service and training, licenses, certifications, even some of your personal learning experiences like parenting, caregiving, community service. And remember to include all of the training that you complete at work. And then second, look for tools that help you to assess your program time and cost and any potential saving opportunities. For example, for us at University of Phoenix, we have a new mobile app that helps potential students identify possible transfer credit. But each college or university, like I mentioned, is going to be a little bit different. And so it's really important to look for a school that has clear policies on transferring credit and assessing credit for prior learning, because schools that provide that information up front really make it easier for potential students to understand what they can expect when they enroll.
What are the benefits for completing a degree if, for whatever reason, somebody wasn't able to do it the first time around? Is it purely a financial benefit in the workplace, or is there something more to it?
Well, of course, there's lots of personal reasons why someone may want to go back to school, fulfilling their goals and, those types of things. But it's really important to understand that for someone considering going back to college, the data shows that getting a degree provides more career opportunities and also increases earning potential. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, people with bachelor's degrees earn about 65% more per week than those with a high school diploma alone. And completing a degree can also be an important foundation to progress in your career. And other reasons might be job security, better benefits, or maybe even flexibility for remote work.
So let's say that I'm working a full-time job and I have a spouse who works a part-time job and some kids who are under the age of 18. I want to go back to school and get that degree, but the cost of obtaining that degree might be beyond my reach. How would I convince my employer to help me pay for it?
This is a really important question. In fact, in our survey, we found that 55% of working adults have self-financed their own professional development, and some have even had to decline opportunities due to cost. But we're also in an era of AI where we know that employers value retaining their talent, and they really want to help their workers upskill and gain more competencies. So because of that, many employers offer tuition benefit programs, and they might have agreements with institutions like University of Phoenix. They may have upskilling programs, apprenticeship programs, and more. So it's really important for workers to check with their company and see what programs and policies they have in place to support them.
How do you respond to the contention that colleges for 18 to 22-year-olds, when there may be 30, 40, 50, and even 60-year-olds who might want to obtain their degree?
Well, like you said at the top of this conversation, there's more than 43 million Americans with some college and no degree. And just because they had to stop for whatever reason came up, earlier in life, that doesn't mean that they can't go back and finish that goal. I think that the reality is more and more institutions out there are looking at that adult learner and saying, hey, we want to support the student. And so there are a lot of opportunities for adults who are thinking about going back to school to really, jump in and get the support they need to finish it.
And possibly even change careers for a second or third act.
Absolutely. We know that the skills that are required in the workplace today are very rapidly changing. And so an adult learner may not be as far behind as they think, because everybody is having to upskill to keep up with the technology changes.
And I would gather that would be more and more frequent as time goes on.
Absolutely.
If we want to send our listeners somewhere for more information and they're not necessarily app friendly, is there a website that we can get them to that'll explain these opportunities?
Absolutely. They can check out more information about our mobile app or get a free pre-evaluation of transfer credit. Go to phoenix.edu/mobile-app.
Okay. We want to thank Devin Andrews for being with us from the University of Phoenix. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
There are more than 100,000 teenagers in Columbus and much more in the five counties that make up Central Ohio. Today's teens are growing up more connected digitally, yet lonelier than ever. Schools are reporting record levels of isolation and burnout. One century-old idea is offering a way back. Through community service, Key Club is helping students rediscover purpose and belonging at a time when both are in short supply. Michelle Studi Campbell is the Executive Director of Youth Programming at Kiwanis International, and she joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about a program called Key Club and how it is rebuilding communities. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. So congratulations. 100 years of service with Key Club, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're starting Century 2 right now.
That's fantastic. How does the Key Club mission with Kiwanis help teenagers feel more connected?
Absolutely. So for 100 years, we have used service to teach leadership and bring about community connections, helping students forge lifetime friendships and connections that really help them feel deeply connected to their community, to their peer groups, and really help students thrive.
What kind of projects are these students leading in their communities?
Yeah, so what's the great part about Key Club is how it can be localized and customized to every community. And so in many communities, we see students, they do a landscape, a survey of the community. Is it homelessness, hunger, animal issues? Is it issues with veterans and other groups that they want to serve and help make an impact? And so the process really teaches students about how to dig deep on the research, connect with other community organizations that are serving, and then create a project that provides impact and certainly meets the needs of students in their own club. And so we see students doing things with animal shelters, food banks, and more.
Here in Central Ohio, back in October, the Dublin Club, which is northwest of Columbus, had an event called the Fall Rally at a place called Scene 75 that was both well covered in the news and extremely popular with the community. Can you tell us a little bit more about how students would have gotten involved in that?
Absolutely. So I'm so glad you mentioned that. So your Ohio district is one of 40-some districts across the globe where we have over 230,000 students who come together to serve and lead. And in Ohio, you have about 10,000 of those students in your community or in your state, and they came together at the Fall Rally to get excited and pumped up about the year ahead, about all their service projects. We have contests, and it's really a community of students coming together to celebrate service and leadership and to kick off the year.
Have you tracked over the course of century number one the progression that these students have in terms of their leadership roles in the community? So, for example, has anyone ever run for public office, or has anyone ever served their community, you know, as a first responder?
Absolutely. So these programs, and in particular Key Club, really help students tap into their civic engagement and their desire and passion for leadership in a much broader way. And so we have, gosh, Capitol Hill is filled with legislative aides and certainly elected officials that have Key Club on their resume. And in fact, we have a global engagement rally that's going to kick off in November, all online, where students can join. And our keynote speaker is a former Key Club member who is now a state representative here in the state of Indiana. And so many of our Key Club students go on to leadership in all walks of life, but in particular in public service.
So how do you get the kids to put their phones down, put the gaming consoles away, and be excited enough to do this and take it seriously and participate with enthusiasm?
Well, after people get over the initial shock of putting the device down for a few minutes, they find that they begin to kind of relax and connect a lot more deeply with their fellow students and with their community. And when you engage in community service, there's a decades-old study, scientific evidence here, that community service, you get what's called a helper's high. And endorphins start really kind of bubbling up, and you get so excited and happy about community service that really students really ages 3 to 103 come back time and time again to get that helper's high, to connect with people and to really help their communities thrive. And then they themselves thrive as well.
Are most of the participants children and grandchildren of active members of the Kiwanis Club, or is there a significant majority outside of that realm?
So that's really a great question. And so in the beginning, when we started, it was absolutely youth, children, and grandchildren of our Kiwanis members. But I got to tell you, we are growing. Kiwanis has about 160,000 members worldwide, and we're at 235,000. And so we have more and more students that are joining Key Club first out and really bringing their parents and family members along with them later on.
How does the school get involved? Do they treat it as an extracurricular activity? Is it a club? How does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So about 95% of our clubs are school-based. It is an extracurricular activity or a club. If you go to keyclub.org, all the information is on there about how to start a club. You know, we have a lot of clubs in Ohio. We can always use more. And we can help you determine if your school has a club, how to start a club. We have Kiwanis clubs throughout Ohio and the country that are available to sponsor clubs and help get those started financially with support. And we're here to help grow Key Club and make sure every student has the opportunity to serve and learn leadership skills.
So what I hear you saying is that the student doesn't have to wait for the school to initiate this endeavor. They can actually do it themselves and then get the school involved afterwards.
Absolutely. We have students email us. I probably get, we get like 10, 20 emails a day with students who want to start a club, and we help them get going.
Okay. So where is the best place for these students to go to learn more and to actively try to make this happen?
Yeah, we invite everybody to keyclub.org. Again, that's keyclub.org. Click on membership, and we'll help you get started to locate a club in your community or start one.
Okay, we want to thank Michelle Studi Campbell for being with us from Kiwanis International, talking about Key Club. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Angela Ann in for Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
The Senate passed Senate Bill 56. This will change marijuana and hemp laws here in Ohio. Now, the bill will impose stricter limits on THC, criminalize the possession and use of cannabis from out of state, and restrict the number of people who could have their records expunged for prior marijuana possession offenses. We asked Governor Mike DeWine if he would sign this bill into law. Here's what he said.
Yes, I'm going to sign the bill. I mean, I've been concerned about this and asking the legislature to take action at least for 2 years. What we have is a situation where people have abused the law. They are selling this intoxicating hemp with a loophole in the law, and there's no regulation over it. So you can walk in, a nine-year-old kid can walk into a gas station and buy intoxicating hemp. There's just no regulation. They have gummy bears that are made out of this intoxicating hemp. And so we're seeing kids who are getting into it and using it. So we need some regulation. We kind of had the wild, wild west out there for a few years, and it brought about kids ingesting it. You know, the number of kids going to the emergency room went up dramatically. So it's finally time that we got control of this, and so I'm going to certainly sign the bill.
Well, joining us now to talk about this decision is Adrienne Robbins. She's from the Ohio Cannabis Coalition. Thank you so much for being here on Face the State. Such a big topic and a big talker for the state of Ohio.
I feel like we've been talking about it all year because we have, obviously, and a really big week for the industry and really for all Ohioans.
So we heard the governor saying that he's been talking about this really for 2 years now. You support this legislation because you say it does protect families. The coalition does. Can you explain how?
In general, over the past couple of years, we saw kind of this emergence of these intoxicating hemp products. But let's be very clear. These are intoxicating products that are unregulated, untested, sometimes lab-made, synthetically made, and again, with no regulations and no age gating. So we were seeing them marketed to children. That's a huge problem anytime you bring this up to people. And they were shocked to find out that they were legal. And they were legal in a gray area, which the federal government ultimately acted on. And now Ohio is really taking a leading approach by closing that timeline even more.
A lot of businesses that are involved in this business, they say this law will now put them out of business and they will hurt their families. So what's the best way then really to protect? Because their argument is, okay, if you want to regulate, why not just make it over 21?
So in general, again, we are talking about the safety of consumers, right? Mm-hmm. So whether you're an adult or a child, I think you should be able to trust the products that you're getting. When you go to a licensed dispensary, you know exactly what is in those products. You know how many milligrams of THC is in those products. You know that they have been tested. You know the state is regulating them. That's something I believe Ohio consumers deserve to have. And as far as businesses going under, honestly, I really doubt that gas stations are just going to cease to exist because they can't sell this one line of products. They've made a lot of money over the past couple of years operating in this legal gray area. They knew it was going to come to an end, and now it has.
Do you feel like so much of this conversation has been because there is a misunderstanding or misconception when people talk intoxicating hemp and they talk cannabis? They just mix the two together, but they are so different.
They're very different. And let's be clear, this all came from a loophole created by the federal government. The loophole has now been closed. Now, anything over that 0.3% of THC is cannabis, and it should be treated as such. Here in Ohio, we have decided to have adult use marijuana sales, and we do it in a safe way. We should not have those products out in gas stations. They should not be at smoke shops or whatnot, because again, Ohio consumers voted to have safe, regulated cannabis products, and now they do.
We talk about revenue. This bill also talks about bringing some of that revenue back to some of those municipalities. Can you explain how that will work?
This was a huge point for OCAN in general and all of our members to be able to give back to those communities that host our dispensaries. And yes, this bill is now releasing some of that funding. We honestly are thrilled. We can't wait till, you know, people start to see the benefit of this industry really at the local level that way. I think it was one really great Christmas present.
How many dispensaries do we have now in the state of Ohio?
So it's always going up, but we have over 150 right now. And I think we're going to continue to see that number rise as consumers learn more and more about this industry, are intrigued by it, and learn that they can find those safe tested products, sometimes right down the street from them.
Yeah. How do we compare to other states? I'm just curious with that number. Sounds like a lot, but more is coming.
More is definitely coming. Yeah. And obviously, we have Michigan up north, which is a much different market than what we have. But we're becoming more and more competitive every single day. And I think this industry is really just going to continue to rise over the next couple of years. We are all very excited to be doing business here in Ohio.
And real quick, Adrienne, we heard the governor say he does plan to sign this bill, but you say you expect a few line item vetoes. Why is that?
We're working on a few issues that I think sometimes with legislation, you don't always know the impact they're going to have. This is a broad broad piece of legislation, as we discussed earlier, hundreds of pages. And so when you start looking through, there's some things that I think we would prefer don't ultimately go through, but we'll wait and see.
See what the governor does. All right. Adrienne Robbins, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, there is another big issue for Governor DeWine. This relates to the death penalty. As he goes into his final year in office, there is still a moratorium on executions here in the state of Ohio. The last one was in 2018. And 10 TV's Station Akin asked the governor about where he stands today on the death penalty.
Well, I'm going to be talking about that. I'm not going to talk about today, but I'm going to come out with a statement, probably in January, about what I think about capital punishment.
Right now in Ohio, there are 112 people sitting on death row, and executions in Ohio have been unofficially paused since 2020. Ohio is caught in a bit of a tug of war as two bills on both sides of the death penalty issue are now working their way through the State House. 10 Investigates' Rochelle Aline explains.
Where do you stand on the death penalty in Ohio, considering the experience you have had?
I am 100% opposed to the death penalty in all forms.
Capital punishment is a sensitive topic for Lamont Hunter Sr.
Yeah, I was wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death back in 2007.
He spent 16 years on death row after being convicted of killing his girlfriend's 3-year-old son. Hunter told 10 Investigates the boy fell down basement stairs. And according to court reporting, at the time of his first trial, a coroner testified that the toddler had actually been shaken to death. But in May of 2023, after that coroner was given new evidence, she changed her mind and Hunter was granted a new trial.
I eventually did what I did, accepted the plea agreement and came home to my family and regained my freedom.
I just want to say that I'm happy to be able to get back to the business of living my life and with my children.
In the end, Hunter pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter and child endangerment and was released on time served.
All the emotions you can think of.
His experience with death row is one not many will ever share, but his opinion on it is becoming more common in our state. A 2023 survey by the Terrence Group found that 56% of Ohioans would swap out the death penalty for life without parole. And in October, almost 30 former lawmakers who helped to reinstate the death penalty back in 1981 added their voices to that chorus through this open letter. They said the law isn't always applied fairly, and the money allocated for it could be better spent helping victims' families or preventing crime. State Senator Nikki Antonio has been working to repeal the death penalty since 2014. Her latest push is waiting to be heard in committee.
I think it's really important that we get this done. And so, we'll keep at it. I do believe we're probably closer than we've ever been.
But not everyone feels the same way. In its latest review of Ohio's capital crime law, the Attorney General's office called out the state for the unofficial moratorium it's had on capital punishment since 2020. It came after a federal judge questioned whether Ohio's lethal injection practices were humane. The AG's office said it will comply with the Trump administration's 2025 push to restore the death penalty nationwide. And that law review also highlighted House Bill 36, which would allow Ohio to also use nitrogen gas for executions. Attorney General Dave Yost testified in support of that bill to a House committee in October.
By failing to keep our promises to the family members of the slain, we dishonor them. Our failure to keep our promises to juries who sacrificed a piece of their lives to do their duty is also dishonorable.
10 Investigates also got a chance to sit down with one of the bill's sponsors, Representative Phil Plummer. And he told me he welcomes the debate surrounding this issue.
Then there's people 100% for it and there's 100% against it. But we, as a society, the rule of law, will sit down and figure it out. You know, I may lose that debate, and if I do, so be it.
Right now, his bill is awaiting another hearing in the House Judiciary Committee. In Columbus, Rochelle Aline, 10 TV News.
Rochelle, thank you. And as we near the end of 2025, Governor DeWine is looking at 2026 as his final year in public office. Earlier last week, 10TV anchor Stacia Nakin sat down with the governor for a one-on-one interview. Here's a part of that conversation.
Governor, you are headed into your last full year as the leader of Ohio, the head of our state. And as far as I know, there's no campaign that you're planning to run after that time.
No.
And that's kind of new, having spent your life in public service. So how do you plan to maximize this last full year?
Well, maximize my last full year is what I intend to do. There's a real sense of urgency. I'll tell you a little story. This is a countdown clock. You can see it there. You see how many days, 395 days, and how many hours, minutes, and even seconds are left until I leave office. It was actually given to me by Jeb Bush, former Governor Jeb Bush. And I think he gives them to all governors who are in their last term. So I have this on my desk.
How do you finish strong, as that says?
I think it's the things that we've laid out that we think are so very important. Kids have one chance to grow up, so we got to get it right with them. We've done some things I think are very positive. We've taken cell phones out of the schools. The science of reading, we know, is the best way to teach kids how to read, but yet in many of our classrooms that was not taking place. And so we have now mandated you have to use the best practice, which is the science of reading. Fran and I have now been, I think, in 40-some schools, 120, 30 different classrooms, seeing how the science of reading works. It's inspiring just to see these kids. They're so engaged. And we know it really changes their life.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM, The Fan 2.